Beginning Monday, May 30th, the Goldbergs, sponsored by the makers of Oxydol, will be presented at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time instead of 12:15 p.m. Remember the change of schedule beginning next Monday. The new time, 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Arthur Dale, West Virginia. In a setting typical of thousands of high school graduations being held throughout the country this month, the Arthur Dale High School's senior class of 13 boys and girls, dressed in the traditional cap and gown, line an iris-banked stage to receive their diplomas. All the time-honored customs of graduation are being observed, but there is this one distinguishing difference that has converged Washington correspondents, photographers, the newsreels, and the broadcasters to this resettlement community of 175 families. The commencement speaker is the President of the United States, the Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt, and his theme is no inspirational message to the graduates, but his decision on the tax revision bill. So this afternoon, the Arthur Dale High School's graduation class will hear the President of the United States announce his decision, whether he has vetoed the tax revision bill, or signed it, or allowed it to become a law without his signature, while the rest of the country eavesdrops by radio. The President will be presented to the graduating class by E. Grant Nine, Principal of the Arthur Dale High School. You now hear Mr. Nine.
In the nation, rare indeed is the opportunity that comes to any community and its high school of having the foremost citizen of the land address its graduating class. Words cannot express the measure of our appreciation for the honor that has come to us upon this occasion. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my very great privilege to present the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
My friends of Arthur Dale, at last, after many attempts dating back through several years, at last I have succeeded in coming to Arthur Dale. And I can greet you as old friends because you are Mrs. Roosevelt's old friends. And also because I've heard so much about you. Much has been written all over the country about you good people, about the conditions of life in certain towns in this part of the world, and about what the United States government has done here at Arthur Dale. The nation has heard about Scott's Run, for example, with its very poor conditions of life. And the nation has heard about Arthur Dale with its vastly improved conditions of life. But I think I voice the thoughts of you who live here when I say to the country over the radio that about the last thing that you would want would be to be publicized as some rare and special type of Americans. I think you'd want to be known as a pretty fair average sample of the best type of American. I think you will agree with me when I put history this way. Back in 1933, the whole nation knew that it faced a crisis in its economic conditions. But the nation did not realize that it also faced a crisis in its social conditions. If anyone were to ask me what is the outstanding contribution that has been made to American life in the past 5 years, I would say without hesitation that it is the awakening of the social conscience of America. As one part, and only one part, of the effort of your government to improve social conditions, we undertook, as you remember, in dozens of places, scattered almost over every part of the country, to set up, with the cooperation of the local people themselves, projects to provide better homes, a better chance to raise foodstuffs, and a better chance to make both ends meet in maintaining a reasonably decent standard of living through the passing years. Many different types of projects were undertaken, some of them in wholly rural sections, some in cities, some in suburbs, some for industrial workers, some for miners, some like Arthur Dale, a combination of industry and farming. These projects represent something new. And because we in America had little or no experience along these lines, there were some failures. Not a complete failure in the case of any given project, but partial failures due to bad guesses on economic subjects like new industries or lack of markets. But on the whole, the percentage of good guesses in the average of these projects has been extraordinarily high. And for this success, the principal part of the credit properly should go to the individual families who themselves have come to live in these new communities. People like you here in Arthur Dale. And incidentally, the lessons that we have all learned are going to save 100 times their cost in dollars, just as fast as government or private capital, or as I hope both of them, go on with the inevitable task of improving living conditions throughout the country, of helping Americans to live as modern science has made it possible for them to live. This extra cost of pioneering ventures such as this, represents development cost, which we justifiably charge off as the inevitable cost of all progress, just as in the past we have charged off the huge government share in the development of railroads, the cost of cables, of airplanes, and hundreds of millions of dollars in the improved highways that have made the automobile possible. But what is equally important to me, the lessons learned from this first bold government venture, those lessons are going to save human lives and human happiness as well as dollars in this march of progress that lies ahead of us. This is a high school graduation, and I'm speaking just as much to you who graduate today as I am to your parents and your grown-up friends, because you are the citizens of tomorrow, not just this graduating class, but thousands of other high school graduating classes in every state in the Union. Last night, a very old and dear friend of mine gave me a little clipping out of a North Carolina paper. And he's with me today, my old chief, the former Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Woodrow Wilson, Josephus Daniels, who is now the United States Ambassador to Mexico. And this clipping brings back a quarter of a century. It's headed May 26, 1913. Franklin D. Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, delivered the commencement address at A&M College in North Carolina. The economics of a life of a people, he said, often seem like academic questions when we study them out of textbooks, but they seem like life or death when we try to feed a hungry family. The question of the production of food supply was an academic question 20 years ago. Today it's becoming a question of bread and butter. So you see that, as my old chief said, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy hasn't changed very much in 25 years. Now I'll carry you back a shorter distance. When you, today's graduates, were of grade school age, we, your elders in the United States, we were asleep at the switch. And your government was also asleep at the switch. For many years, other nations of the world were giving serious attention to and taking definite action on many social problems, while we in the United States were pushing them aside with the idea that perhaps someday we might get around to meeting them. We had heard 10 years ago of the ideals of ending child labor, of initiating a 5-day week, of shortening working hours, putting a floor under wages, clearing slums, bringing electricity into the homes, giving families the chance to build or buy a home on easy terms, starting old age pensions and unemployment insurance. But, my friends, all those things were in the greater part just a beautiful dream. A dream until your government, 5 years ago, got tired of waiting, stepped in and started to make the dreams come true. Now, government has done a little more than start the ball rolling. Government knows how much more remains to be done. But government hopes, now that it has taken the first risks and shown the way, that private capital and businessmen will see how much it is to their own advantage and profit to keep the ball a-rolling, to keep it rolling so well that the inevitable wider improvement in American social conditions will come about in normal course of private enterprise without compelling the government to use large amounts of taxpayers' money to keep America up to date. A great many sincere people, good citizens with influence and money, have been coming to West Virginia mining towns in the past 2 or 3 years to see conditions which under which American families lived, conditions under which, unfortunately, many American families still live. Many of these people who have come up here to this state and to other projects in other states have come to me after, for example, a visit to Scott's Run or similar places, and have expressed to me their surprise and their horror at things they have seen. And they have said to me, "I did not imagine that such conditions could exist in the United States." They have wanted to help at the particular spot they have seen. But the lesson that I have found it difficult to get across to them has been the fact that they have seen only one spot or two spots, tiny, single spots on the great map of the United States, a map that is covered over with hundreds and even thousands of similar spots. The money your government is spending to encourage the nation to live better, especially that part of the nation which most needs it, that money is taxpayers' money. Two questions, therefore, arise. Is that spending of taxpayers' money justified from the point of view of the individual taxpayer? And how should the money be raised? Well, so far as the taxpayer's individual interest is concerned, I always look at it this way. Taxes. And I'm talking about taxes to you who are graduating today just as much as to your parents. For the very good reason that very soon you will be taxpayers yourself. Taxes, local and state and federal combined, are nowhere near as high in this country as they are in any other great nation that pretends to be up to date. If I were a businessman making and hoping to continue to make good profits, I would remind myself as I paid my income tax, moderate by the standard of other nations, that the most important factor in the kind of an active economic life in which profits can be made, the most important factor is people. Able, alert, competent, up-to-date people. People to produce and people with ability to consume. Money invested to make and keep the people of this nation, that kind of people, is therefore a pretty good business investment. And if I were the same man thinking about inheritance taxes on what I was going to leave, what I could leave to my children, I would say to myself that to leave them a living in a nation of strong and able men and women is to leave them a better heritage of security than a few thousand dollars saved on an inheritance tax. Now, how should taxes be paid? For a great many years, the nation as a whole has accepted the principle that taxes ought to be paid by individuals and families in accordance with their capacity to pay. To put it another way, it has meant a graduated tax on a man's increase in wealth. For instance, a poor man or family whose increase in wealth in a given year is below a certain figure pays no direct federal taxes at all. He pays some indirect taxes, but not direct taxes. When the family gains more than $2,500 a year, he gets into the income tax group. And that type of family starts in by paying a small percentage on the year's gains. But as the gains get still larger, the percentage of the tax goes up. So, for example, when a family's wealth increases to, let us say, a gain of $100,000 a year, that family has to pay a third of it to the federal government. And in the case of still richer people, $500,000 income, $1 million a year income, they may have to pay more than half of their large income to the state and to the federal government. Last week, the Congress, 10 days ago, the Congress passed a new tax bill. It contained many good features, improvements in tax administration, the elimination of a number of what we call nuisance taxes on articles in common use, the lightening of the tax burden on the small corporation in accordance with what I recommended to the Congress last fall. And I hope that these changes in this tax bill may be helpful to business, and that this belief may in itself be a factor in the revival of business enterprise. But when the President of the United States has a bill sent to him from Congress, he has to read the whole bill. And so, on the other side of the ledger in this tax bill, I must tell you, quite frankly, that I cannot help but regret that two very fundamental principles of government must once more be called to the attention of the American public. Both of these matters of principle, stripped of every attempt to confuse, are extraordinarily simple and can be understood by every citizen. 2 years ago, in 1936, many large corporations, and especially those big corporations that were owned or controlled by a comparatively small number of very rich stockholders, were in the habit of failing to declare the dividends, the profits, that they'd earned. In that way, these stockholders, small in number, large stockholders, were in a position to leave the profits that their money had made, leave those profits in the controlled corporation, paying, therefore, to the government on those profits only the small, normal corporation tax that ran from 10 to 15%. But at the same time, by this method, these stockholders were able to avoid paying a personal income tax at a much higher rate, at a rate which in many cases would have involved a tax payment of 50% or 60% or even higher, because the stockholders were in what is known as the upper brackets of the personal income tax. Now, the Treasury Department found many instances of closely held corporations which, starting with the comparatively modest capital of several million dollars, and that's considered modest capital by a lot of people, had over a period of years grown into corporations worth several hundreds of millions of dollars, without ever declaring a dividend to their stockholders. That meant a definite, though of course a strictly legal, device. A device by which these stockholders greatly increased their wealth year after year, without having to pay to the government more than a normal corporation tax, and thus escaping very large sums of personal income tax payments. That Revenue Act of 2 years ago sought to end this serious loophole. In principle, our objective was right, but in practice, probably because it was a new thing, the act as finally worked out in the Senate undoubtedly did prevent many small corporations from normal and reasonable business expansion, from building up adequate surpluses, or from paying off old debts. The tax bill this year sought to get rid of these inequitable features quite properly, but to retain at the same time the principle of stopping the tax avoidance that I've described. As finally passed, however, the bill retains the principle, but the penalty for these large corporations, the penalty for withholding dividends to their stockholders, has been made so small, only 2.5% at the most, that it's doubtful, very doubtful, whether it will wholly eliminate the old tax avoidance practices of the past. Now, it's true that the bill seeks to strengthen the authority of the government to act against companies that clearly seek to avoid these surtaxes by failing to declare dividends out of their profits. And I hope that this new provision, together with another recent favorable decision by the Supreme Court in interpreting the old law, that this will retard the revival of the old evil. It seems to me that it's the definite duty and interest of the public, and you are the public, the interest of the legislative and the executive branches of the government, to watch very closely to see what happens during the coming year as a result of these new provisions. We must always remember that this old method of greatly increasing private fortunes through the withholding of corporate dividends was open and useful only to those citizens who already had wealth large enough to control these large corporations. People whose personal income was already large enough to put them in the higher surtax brackets. The position of this administration is of necessity this. We're delighted to remove any existing barriers against every little business or any little business in the United States which is seeking to set itself squarely on its own feet. But the administration doesn't want large, closely held corporations making large profits to be used as a vehicle by the small number of their owners in order to avoid legitimate income taxes. And I think the people of this country are squarely behind the administration in this belief. It's also true that for a number of years it's been recognized that this progressive taxation of wealth realistically ought to apply not only to salaries and dividends and bond coupons, but also to other forms of wealth, such as increases in one's capital by selling any form of property at a profit. That's known as capital gains. And I find many, many people who've never realized what capital gains mean. This new bill that is still before me at this moment wholly eliminates the progressive tax principle with respect to these capital gains. It taxes small capital profits and large capital profits at exactly the same tax rate. And that, my friends, isn't right. In other words, if you or I were to sell stocks that we'd held for a few years at a profit of, let us say, to most of it, it'd sound like a pretty good profit, of $5,000, we'd have to pay a tax of 15% on that profit under this new bill. Whereas the man who's made a profit of $500,000, $500,000 on the stocks that he has owned, is required under this new bill to pay a tax of only 15%, just as you and I. Nobody by any stretch of the imagination, can say that this new provision maintains the principle of payment in proportion to ability to pay. Some people who have favored this abandonment of principle have justified their position on the ground that one has to abandon principles once in a while when there's an emergency, and that the abandonment of this particular principle will encourage many rich men to take a new risk with their capital and invest it in new enterprises. But this school of thought finds it very difficult to answer the fact that almost all, over 80% of all capital gains that are reported are profits made in the stock market. Profits made not by developing new companies, not by starting new industries the way they're being started at Arthur Day. No, no. Profits made by buying stocks of old companies, buying them low and selling them high, or by the still possible method of selling stocks short, selling stocks you don't own. New productive enterprise, and you here in this community know what that term means. It isn't created by the buying of stocks of established companies when they're selling low, when they're low, and buying them when they're high. I should like to see a revision of our tax laws, a revision which would really encourage new enterprise and new investment, and the undertaking by private capital of projects like this that the government has undertaken here in Arthurdale. But there is no assurance that untaxed savings will go into such new investment, such new enterprise. For they may be hoarded, or they may be lost in the inflation or the deflation that occurs in the shuffling about of existing investments. Yes, we as a nation ought to adopt tax policies that will encourage men to venture, men to build new productive wealth. And unless something is added to the combined wealth of the nation, one man's capital gain may be nothing more than another man's capital loss. It will be noted that in this analysis of this abandonment of what I believe is a basic principle, I have attacked no person. I have merely called the attention of the country to certain clear-cut, inescapable facts, and especially to the fact that this tax bill, which is in many respects a good one, actually abandoned the accepted principle of progressive taxation at a point that is very important in our economic life. Here again is an example of a provision of law which actually, and in plain English, gives an infinitely greater tax concession to the man who makes a very great profit than to the man who makes a comparatively small profit. It helps the very few, therefore, at the expense of the many, to carry on a government. You and I know that some definite total sum of money has to be raised, whether it's a county government or a state government or the federal government. If the many who make small capital gains have to pay the same rate as the few who make large capital gains, it means that the tax rate for the little fella must be higher than if we had stuck to the accepted principle of a graduated tax. And that's good logic. So, and in accordance with recommendations that I have made during several years past, I hope that the Congress, when the new Congress comes back next January, will undertake a broader program of improving the federal tax system as a whole, improving it in the light of accepted principles of fairness, fairness in American taxation, fairness in light of the necessary incentives in our economic life. You will see, and I know that many of you have sympathized with me in somewhat similar positions in the past. You will see the difficulty in which your president has been placed. This tax bill contains features that ought to become law, but it also contains several undesirable features, especially the ones that I've just been talking about. Here's the problem. If I sign the bill, and I have until midnight tonight to sign it, many people, with some justification, many people will think that I approve the abandonment of an important principle of American taxation. And if I veto the bill, it will prevent many of the desirable features from going into effect. Therefore, and I'm choosing this occasion, when old and young are gathered together, where people are listening in every state of the Union, I'm taking this occasion to make an announcement. Therefore, for the first time that I have been president, I'm going to take the third course which is open to me under the Constitution. At midnight tonight, this new tax bill automatically will become law, but it will become law without my signature or my approval. By taking that course, I am calling the definite attention of the American people to those unwise parts of the bill that I've been talking to you about today. One of them, a part that may restore in the future certain forms of tax avoidance of the past and of continued concentrated investment power, which we in Washington had begun to put an end to. And the other feature, a definite abandonment of a principle of tax policy, long ago accepted as a part of our American system. Two things we can well remember. The first is that our whole tax system, state, local, and federal, can and must be greatly improved in the coming years. But the other part's worth remembering too, that we in this country are getting more practical results in the way of bettering the social conditions of the nation, getting them out of our taxes than ever before in our history. And that is why it's a pretty good idea to talk taxes not only to the parents of America, but also to the younger generation of America. I've been thrilled today by all I've seen. I've been made happy in meeting so many people that I'd heard a lot about, of seeing them in their own homes, seeing the splendid work that's going on. And I want to tell you, my friends of Arthur Day, that I'm proud of what I've seen here today. And I'm proud of all of you, old and young alike, who are helping so greatly to make this community, an American success.
And so the President of the United States, the Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt, concludes his commencement address before the graduating class of the Arthur Dale West Virginia High School. A commencement address in which the President announced his decision on the tax revision bill to allow it to become a law without his signature. This concludes the Columbia Network's broadcast from Arthur Dale, West Virginia. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.